Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. If you'd like to find more sessions, interviews, and story podcasts, visit our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. This podcast features a program session from the EDUCAUSE 2010 Annual Conference.
Well, good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and get started because we have a lot of territory to cover today. My name is Rodney Peterson. I'm with EDUCAUSE in our Washington office, joined today by Patrick Feehan from Montgomery College and Maura Johnston from the University of Pennsylvania. And for those of you who were expecting Shirley Payne, she regrettably could not be with us at the last minute. What we're going to do today is I'm going to give you a very quick lightning round version of what's happening in identity, privacy, and security in Washington, D.C., somewhat of a flyover at a high level, even though you're not supposed to be doing that near the Capitol in Washington, D.C., but try to give you some high-level overview. And then we'll quickly move into a discussion about what this means for the institution in terms of campus policy and practice, and welcome your questions and comments, and maybe more specific questions related to what I'm going to cover very quickly at the beginning here. So let me start by just saying a couple things about the Congress, and I am leaving intentionally out all my jokes for this particular session, but as many of you may know, the elections are around the corner. In fact, the only joke I will say is the good news is that the politicians are all out of town for the next several weeks, so that makes my life a little easier that I know they're not up to any mischief up on Capitol Hill, but they're out in your districts probably causing the mischief they usually do in Washington, D.C. But that is very significant, as any of you may know who've been following politics, because the Democrats who've been in control for the past 2 years are very concerned about losing control over the Congress, not as if the bills have been passing very swiftly even under a democratically controlled Congress, but obviously a lot of attention focused on the election. So what will happen when they come back sometime in mid-November and December is what we call the lame duck Congress, and that's actually when the mischief will truly happen, because regardless of the outcome of the election, if the Democrats regain control, they're going to try to continue to push things through as quickly as possible, or more importantly, if they lose control, they're going to try to slide some things through while they still have majority. So what makes this particularly complicated for the areas that I follow for EDUCAUSE, identity, privacy, and cybersecurity, is there's just conflicting jurisdiction. In fact, in a moment, when you hear me talk about the variety of activity going on in all the federal agencies, more or less the way Congress organizes itself is it has a committee for every agency that exists in the government, and the committees are there for oversight. And internet policy doesn't fit neatly within any single committee. And in fact, issues of privacy, cybersecurity in particular, have overlapping jurisdiction with committees, whether it's judiciary, whether it's commerce, whether it's homeland security. So a number of bills get introduced at the committee level, hearings are held, but it's really hard to get them passed through because of the conflicts in jurisdiction. But I just wanted to quickly focus on a few key items of legislation that have been pretty prominent in the news, or maybe not so much, but that you should be aware of. The Senate bill that 773 that Senators Rockefeller and Snow introduced, called the Cybersecurity Act, was first known quite controversially for its provision about the, you know, the president would unplug the internet or unplug your connection to the internet when mischief was happening. But in all seriousness, it is a pretty comprehensive look at the kinds of authorities the Department of Homeland Security needs, the kind of coordination that needs to happen across sectors, and through some later revisions tries to tone down that, you know, powers, if you will, that the executive branch would have. But quite frankly, despite it being introduced fairly early on with a variety of hearings and conversations around that bill, it has not moved as quickly through. And I think largely because it is so comprehensive and so far-reaching, it's quite difficult to get the particular pieces that might be important through. So the second bill I wanted to just mention is a Senate bill on data security and breach notification that was not introduced until late summer in August. And this is one of a series of bills that have been trying to deal with the fact that we have some 46 state breach notification laws, and a uniform federal law might be more desirable. Again, what's interesting here is that the authority for enforcement is under the Federal Trade Commission, and why this might be worth watching is that a similar bill did pass the House of Representatives in December, also known as the Data Act, the Data Accountability and Trust Act, H.R. 222. 321 if you're interested. And I tell a lot of people not to worry about that because the jurisdiction under the FTC is for for-profit businesses, and it didn't necessarily include colleges and universities. In fact, we had some meetings with them where they were tempted to include us and decided not to. But the Senate version does include not-for-profits, and because it's coming out of the Senate, if it does move forward, you can expect a conference between those two bills to potentially be the kind of legislation that could be, if not standalone, certainly attached to some kind of spending or appropriations bill that you learn about the next day because it passes in the middle of the night. Now, the final thing, just in terms of legislation, there's been a lot of discussion for the past several years about the need for comprehensive privacy legislation in the U.S., and unlike other countries, we do not have such a comprehensive privacy bill. There's a lot of things known as fair information practices and things that companies and universities and the like do voluntarily in the interest of principles related to privacy. Congressman Boucher from Virginia has talked about introducing a bill, in fact issued a draft back in May, but more recently over the summer, Representative Bobby Rush from Chicago introduced the Best Practices Act, which essentially was a privacy bill to try to protect consumer information being used by commercial companies. So again, another question about whether or not it would apply to colleges and universities, but these kinds of pieces of legislation are certainly of more attraction, if you will, under the Obama administration and a Democratic Congress that tends to be a little more sympathetic to privacy issues than the Republicans have been previously. Let me move into what's happening in the White House. So many of you may know a year ago I probably talked about the cyberspace policy review, happened in May 2009, had a series of recommendations presented to the President. One of them, the first and foremost, was to create a position in the White House focused on cybersecurity. That happened. You'll see a photo here of Howard Schmidt. Howard actually spoke at an EDUCAUSE conference 3 years ago. He's been a very good friend of higher education, a very competent, capable person, used to work at eBay, at Microsoft, a number of other places. What's interesting about his position is that it not only reports to the National Security Council, which is an obvious place for a security kind of issue, but also the National Economic Council. And I think this has changed the conversation a little bit, that certainly we're not just concerned about cybersecurity in terms of bits and bytes and what happens to safety issues, but the impact on the economy, which obviously is driving a lot of the homeland security concerns. So that was a big move. And then I'm not going to read this to you, but in the context of National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, last year the President issued a video, this year a proclamation, which just continues to reinforce, you know, both the promise and the peril of technology and the implications for cybersecurity, the need for awareness. One of the initiatives in this comprehensive cyber review was the need for more education to improve the workforce and also for awareness. And so the government has instituted this national initiative for cybersecurity education known by the acronym NICE, N-I-C-E. There's a URL there for the website. It has four particular tracks. The first one focused on awareness. The second one focused more on the formal education, and you'll see the Department of Education and the Office of Science and Technology Policy are the leads there. The next two are a little more specific related to the government workforce, but I think you can expect those of you who have academic programs at your institution to have a lot of interest in track two. All of us who do security awareness for our faculty, staff, and students with respect to uses of our systems are going to be very interested in continuing to follow track one. Which brings me to Happy National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Hopefully most of you are aware that that happens every October. The Higher Education Information Security Council promotes it. It grows every year, both in terms of participation across higher education, K through 12, private sector, industry, and government organizations. The banner at the top here puts forth the theme of our shared responsibility, something certainly for you to take back to your institution. It's not just IT's responsibility. It's responsibility of all the business units, and certainly all the responsibilities of the users. But at the bottom here, you'll see a Stop, Think, Connect logo here and a new website, stopthinkconnect.org. And this was just launched at the beginning of October as part of the new national awareness campaign, which again goes back to the President's White House cyberspace policy review that recommends we need to have a national campaign and certainly that higher education and again all the different sectors of the economy can leverage for awareness. So a lot more to come on that campaign, but again in fulfillment of some of the earlier recommendations. Another recommendation in the White House else. Policy review was to develop a strategy related to identity management, and that has begun in earnest. As you see here, the vision is to address secure, efficient, easy-to-use, interoperable identity solutions for access to online services. The draft of the strategy came out in July. There was some indication that a final strategy would be released in October. We're in October, and none of us have seen that yet. And, in fact, my latest information is it will probably not be until after the first of the year. But like most of these national strategy conversations, it really is an activity to bring different communities together to talk, to plan, to work towards a future, whereas you'll see some of the goals here that we need a more kind of comprehensive identity ecosystem. System framework, building and implementing an interoperable identity infrastructure, enhancing confidence and willingness to participate. And this certainly is targeted towards our end users, our consumers, our citizens, our students, faculty, staff, and then the long-term success. So I think all of us know in higher education kind of the criticality of identity and access management at our institution, with the introduction of federations like In Common, not only to federate with each other but with other agencies and other organizations. This is going to be a critical issue that more will be heard about in the future. Now I'm going to really go into lightning round mode because I don't have a lot to say about the following ones, but just to give you an example of how every agency is talking about privacy or cybersecurity in one context or another, the Federal Trade Commission held a series of three workshops or roundtables on exploring privacy. And if you look through the list here, which I won't read, but you go to the website, you can see lots of testimony. You can actually watch the webcasts that were recorded. You can see the kinds of challenges and opportunities that are presented by the new digital technologies, including cloud computing and mobile computing and the like. And so the Federal Trade Commission will be issuing a report and a series of recommendations, again, coming out probably around the first of the year. The Department of Commerce, the NTIA, National Telecommunications and Information Administration, many of you may know that it's through a contract with the NTIA that EDUCAUSE administers the .edu domain. You may also know that under the stimulus funding, the NTIA was the one giving out the broadband grants more recently. But they also have this lesser-known Internet Policy Task Force that's trying to look at a variety of policy issues, more specifically to our talk here today, privacy policy and innovation workshop, as well as a request for comments, which we did comment on very recently. They also had a similar one in cybersecurity. They're planning to do the same on intellectual property in the near future. Many of you have probably also heard, maybe at a session here at the conference, about the National Broadband Plan that the FCC issued this past year. And obviously lots of goals and intentions there addressing broadband needs in America, but not surprisingly, promoting cybersecurity and the protection of that broadband infrastructure was also embedded in this plan, and several recommendations related to cybersecurity, including this first one here that the FCC should issue a roadmap. And a few weeks ago, they put out their request for comments regarding input into that particular roadmap. Here's one that will probably interest you a lot and one to certainly follow because, as many of you know, the U.S. Department of Education is most notable to us because of its enforcement of FERPA through the Family Policy and Compliance Office. You may be aware that the longstanding director of that office left the department a couple years ago, just prior to the administration change. An interim person was appointed who didn't last very long, quite frankly, and that position has been vacant for several months. And, in fact, more recently, they've kind of changed their minds, so to speak, about how they're going to be organizing. Namely, they are going to be appointing for the first time ever a chief privacy officer in the Department of Education that will oversee not only FERPA compliance but many other things. The thing to watch here is some of the language and the terms they're using. They're talking about safeguarding student privacy. So for any of you that thought FERPA was only about privacy, it's going to be about security in the very near future. In fact, a couple years ago in their FERPA proposed regulations, they had some recommendations related to security and safeguarding student information. I think you'll see more of that coming in the near future as they have several initiatives, as they say, to protect data privacy and ensure confidentiality and data security, so you can begin to see the privacy security kind of umbrella broaden a little bit. They've hired contractors to set up a privacy technical assistance center. They've been telling us for months and weeks that they're going to come out with updated FERPA regulations again. I mentioned hiring a chief privacy officer. They're in the process of writing some case studies and technical briefs and looking at some improvements to the FPCO office. also somewhat coming from the Department of Education, but certainly being financed through a number of different sources, are the state longitudinal data systems. And again, we're going to have maybe some discussion about this in a moment. But just to know, there's a lot of federal support of these longitudinal data systems at the state level. And the goal here initially was to link what we knew of as P through 20, preschool through K through 12 through higher education, and then more recently workforce data, so that we can begin to monitor and track student success, student outcomes from the early childhood education level up until they enter the workforce. And so some of the funding, of course, that has gone into creating this is really speeding up the adoption in states, including a recent May issuance of $250 million, where part of the requirement was that it linked to post-secondary systems. So I suspect many of you in the room are having conversations, particularly if you're at a public institution, with your state departments of education, other state government actors, about how you are going to link your post-secondary systems to the K through 12 systems. And without going into detail here, the controversy not only currently, but certainly when a similar proposal was on the table a couple of years ago, was concerns about ownership and who has the ability to make decisions about sharing data, certainly the security of that data, obviously based upon who's maintaining the systems and operating it, and then most importantly, perhaps, is the privacy implications for the students and the individuals whose data is now being collected and shared and used perhaps in ways that they had never before thought possible. So another area, kind of shifting gears a little bit, many of you probably have heard in the past about the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Note that it was from 1986, and if any of you have been following technology developments for the last 2.5 decades, a lot has changed, and certainly the law has not kept up with those changes. So there's been a lot of discussion, including following the Patriot Act and efforts after 9/11 to give the government more powers to try to address the balances there for privacy, again, for individual users, and the changing realities in terms of how information is used and located and stored, and that people no longer necessarily possess the communications. It might be a third party, an email service provider, or in our case, a university who actually holds the communication, not the individuals. And so there's been a couple hearings in the past month related to ECPA reform, and as you see, the title of the first one was related to promoting security and privacy in the digital age, so trying to bring the law up to date. And then the House also had a hearing looking at the cloud computing implications of privacy and particularly the needs for reforming the law. EDUCAUSE recently joined something called the Digital Due Process Coalition, and you can read or see if you look at the slides later or go to the website what some of the principles are that they're pursuing. This is a multi-industry effort, including individual faculty members from a number of institutions, public interest groups, American Library Association, Association of Research Libraries, and others. We're really trying to work together to try to strike that right balance between protecting individual privacy and also give law enforcement the tools it needs. So that's my high-level, quick, lightning round tour of what's happening in Washington. And again, I'll welcome at the end your comments and questions about any of these topics or certainly understanding the relevance. But we do have a panel here because we wanted to kick off some discussion about what these kind of issues at the federal level or perhaps similar issues at the state level really mean in terms of translating policy into practice. For those of you that don't know, I worked at the University of Maryland College Park before coming to EDUCAUSE, and it's been about 10 years now since I left that director of policy position there to be an EDUCAUSE staff member. And even though I like to think I still understand the connection, sometimes you can live almost in my own ivory tower in the policy space and not understand whether these things really impact or are relevant to what happens on a regular basis on campus. What I do know, certainly in the last 10 years, that compliance and policy and privacy and all the issues we've been talking about today are probably more important than ever. So we have Patrick Feehan and Maura Johnston here from their respective roles at their institutions to kind of help us dive into some discussion about the policy and practice implications. So let me just first turn to Maura and maybe ask you to talk a little bit, specifically by way of introduction, what your role is at the University of Pennsylvania, and then more importantly, how are you organized to address compliance and policy and practice issues around identity, privacy, and information security? Maura?
Thanks, Rodney. Can everybody hear me back there? I'm kind of soft-spoken. Wait, you can't. Okay, I got a thumbs up. Great. Thanks. I am the privacy officer for the university. We also have a privacy officer for the health system side of things at Penn. And the privacy function is housed in the Office of Audit, Compliance, and Privacy. the Associate VP for Audit Compliance and Privacy reports to our Executive Vice President of the university and also to a Trustees Committee Audit Compliance. Privacy hasn't been tacked on yet. It's a Trustees Committee for Audit and Compliance. We also work very closely, of course, with the information security people who are housed within information systems and computing. On that side of things, the Vice President for Information Systems and Computing reports also to the Executive Vice President for the university, but also to the Provost. So it's a little bit divided, but we work together very, very closely. And I see, by the way, some of my colleagues are here, so they'll keep me honest. If I leave anything out, wave at me. So that's basically what our structure is.
Okay. So we have a private institution. As I said, for those of you that came in late, Shirley Payne, who couldn't be with us from the University of Virginia, would have represented a large, you know, research university perspective. We have Patrick Feehan here, who is from just a little tiny two-year college in the suburban areas of Maryland. But say a little bit about Montgomery College and then, again, your role, how you're organized to deal with these issues.
Yeah, Montgomery College. I'm the Director of Privacy and Cybersecurity Compliance at Montgomery College. And we are a two-year organization. We have three campuses in Maryland and I think about 26,000 full-time students. So we move things around a lot.
Yeah, not so tiny.
Not as tiny. No, we're tinier. I see some Virginia people here. I see. And what's evolving in our role is that if Shirley were here, she and I have talked about this a lot of times, that about the same time we both inherited records management as part of our tasks. And you wonder how records management ties into someone who's the director of privacy and cybersecurity compliance. Well, when you inherit a warehouse full of about 10,000 boxes of documents, and then you begin to recognize that every department at the college has probably another 10,000 stuck in every office, every nook and cranny, you recognize the power of information and where it lies. And so you begin to think in this position about structuring as we are in a data governance situation, that we are going to have privacy and security and records management and compliance, education, awareness and training, business continuity, disaster recovery, and risk management, all under our data governance model. Because this, it helps give us focus, because when you suddenly are confronted, as the people of Virginia were confronted the same way, with suddenly how much records exist everywhere, not in paper form, not only in paper form, but all sorts of forms, you recognize that you need to know how records are created, how they're used, how they're stored, and how, crossing fingers, someday they're actually destroyed. And so to know all those things is a gathering of disciplines that sometimes get scattered around a university setting, and what we're trying to do is bring them together so we can bring focus on governing the data that's everywhere in our system.
So the next question I want to ask you about current issues, policy compliance issues you're addressing at your institution, and just a little slight advertisement here. A few years ago, I wrote an article for the EDUCAUSE Review Policy at EDU talking about the life cycle, and I'm well aware that much of what I shared with you is kind of things you're going to have to deal with in the future, right? I mean, these are public policy issues, potentially legislative issues, and even the data law that I talked about with breach notification is going to require an agency to come up with rules and regulations, and eventually it'll trickle down to a campus, much like the Higher Ed Opportunity Act did a year ago for the campus to do something. But whether or not it's related to what I presented, what are you actually dealing with currently in the past few months at your institution related to policy and compliance? What are some of the topics that are crossing your desk?
One of our major areas right now in terms of policy and compliance is we recently developed a new computer security policy and at the same time updated our social security number policy. And those changes were driven not entirely but partly by legal requirements. In Pennsylvania, we have a breach notification law that says if we were to release without authorization SSN numbers and other personal data like bank account numbers and credit card numbers and so on, that we would have to notify individuals. And that's, of course, you know, because SSNs are such an important part of identity theft. They're very, you know, prized, so they need a lot of protection. So in response to that requirement, we've had an SSN policy in place for quite a while, but we included in our updated version an encryption requirement, and it has to do with mostly portable devices. So at the same time, we developed this new computer security policy, and it has been driven in part by the changes in FERPA and HIPAA, the additional tightening of the security requirements there. It brings together existing computer security-related policies, but again adds encryption requirements, mostly having to do with portable devices. So I'm saying the word encryption over and over again. It became clear to us that in order to implement these policies, and the date is in December, this coming December, to implement these changes, there would need to be some guidance for the campus, the community, to be able to implement the encryption requirements, because as you know, there are so many different ways you can do encryption, and some require less management and some require more. We have a campus PGP, whole disk encryption service, that you can purchase, or you can do TrueCrypt, or you can do BitLocker, which is, you know, coming along with Windows 7. So we wanted to provide some guidance and to the areas large and small, mostly small, because the larger ones have more IT people, to help them implement the policies. So long story long, I guess, we put together what we called a special session and invited IT leaders and, you know, IT people in general to this session where we presented on the changes in the policies to try to make sure that there was awareness out there, and then also had our technical people give a high-level overview of the encryption options. Then the following day, we had a more technical session for the more technical people to understand the support requirements going with the different kinds of encryption and what the overall technical requirements would be like. So we're hoping that that has laid the foundation for compliance by December.
Good. Patrick?
We have a saying at our institution that PCI never dies. It's a bit like a whack-a-mole in that it, I think you've probably all been through this, but people will seek their own solutions and gravitate to their own solutions. And as things pop up, we're always finding new and innovative ways people accept credit cards at our university. And so that's a continuing effort, because we're trying to get out of using the long-form PCI audit and get into the really cool 21-question PCI audit by we don't want to store any numbers. And it's hard to get there, but we're getting closer and closer. So that never dies. Records management policy, we're rewriting that to reflect our data governance efforts. Our current records management policy was written in 1997. And then we wrote a network and information security program, which was modeled after ISO 27002, of which I am a member of the editorial board, and we can give out that link later. But tried to mirror the ISO rules, because it's a great framework. It's a great security framework for any of you who have worked with it. And lastly, we're writing our AUP, our acceptable use policy, was written in 1997 and has, I think at last count, 57,000 words or something in that area, of which 47,000 say IT is a rat and cannot be trusted with email, cannot be trusted with stuff. So we have to police IT, and so to me it's a fairly useless document that Rodney and I discuss these things, but as an attorney I believe I can cover this in about one paragraph. I don't need the 2,000 words devoted to what a rat IT is. I can state that explicitly.
So just quickly, the reference to the ISO 27002 standard is the Higher Education Information Security Council has an information security guide. If you go to the www.educause.edu/security/guide, is a resource there based upon ISO 27002, but cross-referencing NIST and COBIT and PCI-DSS and some of the other standards that multiple places use, but trying to at least provide some guidance to the community. Mary Dunker, who I see faculties in the room is the co-chair of that editorial board. So if you have any questions, you could either talk to Patrick or maybe Mary, but it is a resource that we've tried to put together for the community. So, Maura, you talked a little bit about guidance and trying to help the campus understand, in your case, Social Security numbers, or I guess encryption was the specific example. And another issue that, other than the one hearing I referred to, cloud computing, I suspect many people on campus have been trying to figure out what guidance, if any, to give in cloud computing. Can you share a little bit of what your institution has done in that regard?
Sure. Probably like everybody here, we heard a lot about, you know, kind of scuttlebutt about how cloud computing was being used ahead of any kind of policy or guidance by people on campus, and especially in the research area for collaboration with people in other institutions. So it was on our radar, and we were, you know, taking very seriously the privacy and security potential threats to university data. So given that that horse was, you know, to some extent already out of the barn, then what do you do? You can't tell people, well, I guess you could, but it wouldn't be effective to tell people they can't do what they're already doing without offering some kind of useful alternative. So in any event, we had lots of conversations around campus with various groups that are interested in IT and privacy and security, and put together a draft guidance rather than policy, because we felt that the area is in so much flux technologically, you know, and otherwise, that it probably wouldn't make sense to try to nail down a policy. So we drafted a policy, did a lot of vetting with it. Guidance, and did a lot of vetting of it. And one of the major areas where we did the vetting was with the Vice Provost for Research, because the research area is such a large user of cloud services. So we ended up with guidance that we felt comfortable with, and we published it in the Almanac, which is the university, they call it the Journal of Record. It's the place where people are supposed to, you know, follow what's going on in terms of policies and guidance. And the guidance, just to give you a very short idea, is in two parts, really. One is guidance on the law. So, I mean, it's guidance, guide you to the law, but it's pointing out what's required, especially with regard to FERPA and HIPAA, that you can't, you're not allowed under the law to put your data someplace out of your control without having adequate controls over the data. So, in other words, a contract or some form of adequate control. And that doesn't include typically the click-through agreements. It usually requires some sort of negotiated agreement, which is a problem with a Google or, you know, other large entity that doesn't want to sit down and negotiate with a single faculty member or maybe even a single university, but to raise awareness about the legal requirements. And then the other side of the guidance was to point out, even if there's no legal requirement to protect your information, you might want to think about protecting it anyway because you probably care about it. So the guidance points to concerns like, you know, is the company going to still be there when forever? Google will, but maybe not some of the smaller ones. Is there security that you can be comfortable with? Is there support if you need to get data that's in storage in the large amount of data? Can you find it? Those kinds of things. So if you have any interest in seeing it, you know, it's on our website in the Almanac.
So my next two questions, I want to actually get a little audience participation. So the first one, I'm going to talk a little bit about breach notification laws. I refer to the fact there's actually been several, but there's one that may seriously get some traction here that would apply to higher education. So let me just ask, and I'll tell you what the two-part question is before you raise your hand. How many of you are perfectly happy with your state law or the current environment you're operating under is part A. Part B is, how many of you would prefer to see a uniform national law, a single law that would in effect supersede all state law? So the first question is, how many of you are perfectly happy with your state law or current requirements and would like to see the status quo? Any hands raised? Okay. Okay, and put your hands down. How many of you would prefer to see a uniform federal national law passed? Okay, so Patrick, do you want to share your experience or just kind of talk a little bit about kind of what your reactions are, what the thoughts here about a uniform federal law?
I see Heidi Wachs back there.
Smiling.
Smiling.
Laughing.
I'm in Maryland, right across that rugged border between Maryland and Washington, D.C. lies Georgetown University, and it kind of points out how the Maryland law works, which says you need to report a breach to the Attorney General, except if you're a state agency, and I'm a state agency, so I really like the Maryland law. Now, Heidi, across the border at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., of course, is not a Maryland state agency, so Heidi has to report a breach to the Maryland Attorney General. So this works unfairly on my good friend, but the Maryland law right now, I guess you could say, is it was watered down, it was beaten, and doesn't refer to any state agencies. We are not required to report to the AG. Now, would we report? Of course we would. Should what happens to us ever happens like what happens to Heidi, then we would certainly report that too. But as it stands right now, a uniform law is probably going to be more difficult on me than my existing state law.
So let me just make one comment, and then I do want to welcome comments or questions on this topic from the audience. In the hearing that was held, I guess, almost a month ago now, there was testimony from a variety of people, including government agencies, saying why this was a good thing. But what caught my attention was a hospitals association who the representative said this uniform federal law is actually not a good thing because we already have one for hospitals, the High Tech Act. You know, under the reporting requirements for breach notification there, they already have to report to Health and Human Services. And you could probably say the same thing about higher education under certain contexts. You know, Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act has reporting requirements. Many of you probably got that little nice letter from the Department of Education, from the Financial Aid Division saying, hey, keep us informed about your security breach regarding student information, da-da-da-da-da. And you could go down the line where there are probably some existing authorities. But the question that got thrown back to the person is, what if your employees at your hospital or medical center's information was disclosed? Is there any federal law that makes you notify them or requires you to notify them? And, of course, the answer was no, unless it was health information about the employee. So I think that's part of the conundrum, is we don't have a law that would comprehensively address various types of information. But even then, as the hospitals pointed out, and as Patrick and many others might point out, you might still have multiple reporting requirements depending on the type of information. Let me just see if there are any comments or questions about this issue, because certainly EDUCAUSE has been generally taking the position that a good uniform law is probably in the best interest than multiple state laws, but you know, we certainly have examples like Patrick's here where a certain state situation might leave them better off. Yes.
Yeah, of course.
I'll repeat this because I know not everybody can hear it, so try to keep them brief so I can repeat it. Right. So the good comment was the devil's in the details, which is absolutely true. And if any of you are really interested, again, go back to that Senate bill that I referenced earlier in the slides. They will be up online, or let me know, and look at the details. But the question about what triggers notification, as many of you know who have fought this at the state level, is kind of a critical issue. And then secondarily, what other kind of consequences might there be? And I will say this particular bill, when we met with staff before it was even introduced, you know, we didn't like anything that was going to potentially be an unfunded mandate, right, that was going to cost all of you money, including providing credit reports to and credit monitoring services to somebody who wanted it. Now, the bill doesn't say you absolutely have to do it, but if one of the people you notify says, okay, I'll take advantage of that, then you, the institution, has to pay. Or, like many of these bills, in this case, under Federal Trade Commission enforcement, there are fines, penalties if you don't comply with certain provisions as well. So there are potentially some costs there and consequences. Another hand was up in the middle. Comment? No? Okay, so let me move to my second topic, which is the state longitudinal data system one. When I mentioned that earlier, I saw some heads nodding in the room, so hopefully some of you who are perhaps dealing with that at your institution will share, you know, just briefly your stories and what your experiences are. Now, I introduced this as a federal issue because obviously a couple of years ago when the Department of Education wanted to mandate this of higher education as part of the student unit record system process, it created a lot of controversy. In fact, the Congress, you know, explicitly said, we will not require post-secondary institutions to do this. Well, what's happened, fast forward a couple of years later, is all this money is now enabling the states to do it. So now the states are putting the pressure on post-secondary education, not the federal government per se, to do this at the local level. And so what's interesting to me is legislation that I've seen at the state level that both enables this as well as potentially legislation that could block this from happening. And Maura, you may have a story to share there.
I do. We have a story in Pennsylvania about a proposed legislation that would block the collection in the higher ed context. What's happening is the Pennsylvania Department of Education collects extensive longitudinal data in K through 12, grades K through 12, and the department is proposing extending that collection to higher ed. And just to give you an idea of the kinds of elements that are collected, name, address, date of birth, race, social security number, major, GPA, well, these are the proposed ones, SAT, ACT Act, credits attempted, credits earned, family income, counseling incidents, tutoring incidents, remedial courses passed, remedial courses failed, and more. So it's a very detailed data set that they would want to collect in the higher ed setting. In the Pennsylvania State Senate, a bill was introduced that would prevent the department from doing this. And my colleague, Lauren Steinfeld, who's a senior advisor for privacy and compliance at Penn, testified on this. I believe it was the day before yesterday. And her comments were, I'm going to characterize generally, to point out that this type of data shouldn't be collected without, very strong and stated purposes. And I'm going to take the liberty, if I may, of just referring to one paragraph of her testimony to summarize it. A responsible large-scale data collection of personal information should include the following elements, which I offer as a way to discuss productively the privacy issues. One, the collection should be justified by specific articulated benefits that will result from such a collection. The data collected, uses, and availability of the data should be narrowly tailored to achieve articulated benefits. The database should be safeguarded with current tested privacy and security controls. And then lastly, the processes used and outcomes achieved should be transparent to the public, and there should be a strong accountability structure in place. So that's where we stand right now. That's the legislation that's pending now.
And Patrick, you have a slightly different version of the story from Marilyn, and then I would hope some other people here might have experiences or questions you would ask.
Pennsylvania is so cerebral. I mean, in Maryland, there was a large check presented, and it was we're on our way. There was a committee formed and on how to institute this, and I believe they have to have a report to the legislature by mid-2011 on how to implement this so they can cash the check. I think it was nothing like this has happened yet where there's any pending legislation to stop it, but I think it's a very similar effort to the one that the legislation is attempting to impede in Pennsylvania.
So let me just see a quick show of hands, affirmative, affirming that your institution has been approached or is planning or in some way is working towards linking your post-secondary data to some other types of educational data. Shows of hands. Maybe a quarter of the people in the room. Anyone who raised your hand or others have an experience or a story to share in terms of why you're doing it, what's driving it? Yes. Why don't you stand up and maybe turn and try to project, because I may not be able to repeat all this, but just briefly give your story, yes. All right. And by the way, I mentioned earlier the new FERPA rules that might be coming out, and it's my understanding a lot of these new proposed rules are to address what many people believe are potentially FERPA violations with respect to the sharing of these records. Now, having said that, I've talked to many campus legal counsel who say regulations aren't going to fix something maybe that the law already sets the bar for, so it may be more than regulations that are needed. Any other institutional stories about longitudinal data systems or initiatives in your institutions? Anyone? So I would encourage you, if you're interested in kind of learning more and tracking this, there's a couple organizations that are pretty actively involved, including EDUCAUSE increasingly getting involved in it, particularly to understand some of the ownership, privacy, and security implications. SHEO, the State Higher Education Executive Officers Organization, SHEO.org, has a status report, 2010 status report of longitudinal data systems in post-secondary education. So that would be a great resource to kind of come up to speed in what's happening at the post-secondary level. And then the Data Quality Campaign is a group that's been funded largely by the Dow Foundation to actually promote and advocate for these systems. And again, with the understanding that, the goal is not a bad one there in terms of tracking and monitoring student progress and success and trying to get increased graduation rates and the like. They've been criticized by moving too quickly and not considering some of the policy issues, yet at the same time, I know they are trying to look at privacy and security in and other implications as well. So if you go to the datacualitycampaign.org website, in front and center, I think, on their homepage, you'll see a little map there that talks about the different states that are adopting these. And as I said, it's not only K through 12, post-secondary, but the more recent efforts are to get in the early childhood education and then the workforce data as well. Let me just ask one more question and see if there's other audience questions. So obviously, as you're developing policies and practices and guidance and the like, the real challenge is not to write this all down, but to have your campus community know about it, to make them aware, to educate them. Can each of you talk a little bit about what you do, is either as part of your function or other functions on campus, to promote awareness and education about policies and best practices and guidance and the like? More?
Thanks. We try to use every, you know, tool. We have a broad arsenal. We try to do everything we can think of to get the news out when we have a new policy or guidance, recognizing that the Almanac journal that I referred to is read by most people, but reading a fairly, you know, complex policy or guidance once isn't going to make it stick. So we have a variety of ways of trying to get the news out. We have we have technically focused groups. One is called the Super Users Group. We have a special interest group. We have a group called IT Privacy, where we discuss and vet things before they become official. There's an IT roundtable of more senior IT and privacy people where we get the news out. And when I say get the news out, we have our fingers stretching out into the university through a system of liaisons. We have privacy liaisons and security liaisons. And these are volunteers in the schools and centers who they have volunteered to help get the word out on new policies and guidance. And also the information flow works in both directions, because we ask them to let us know about issues that maybe we could work on centrally and help to resolve. And also, they hear about some issues before we, meaning the central we, hear about them. So it's a two-way street. And then we also have, you know, the published ways of getting news out. But I think the people ways are probably even more important than the published ways.
Patrick?
Yeah, we have we are doing the things that you're all doing with it's Cybersecurity Awareness Month, so there are posters and there are efforts being made around, and there are talks, et cetera. But we found in the last year is that going to departments one at a time is a much more effective than anything we're doing with top-down policy, that when we're creating a policy and then you try to communicate that, whether it's in some college-wide publication or in emails or something like that, to go to one department at a time and make a presentation to, here's the issue, here's what we're trying, how we're trying to solve the issue, is proving really effective. People get very enthused when you break it down into, that would be me. Sorry about that.
Do you have a policy about phones going off in the middle of conference presentations?
Yes, you turn off your phone. But we found just going face to face. I just last week I met with our Department of Human Resources, which has about 60 employees, and to sit down and take them through what dangers lurk, and then to talk and ask questions and find out maybe if fully 30 of those 60 people are pulling down data from our enterprise systems and putting it into who knows what kinds of things, who knows where the data is going. So it's a great occasion for us to go, and it always initiates that I'll be back. I didn't mean to sound like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but I mean that I will be back, because now we've had this intro and they recognize that it really does pertain to what they're doing. We're not out there just creating these policies which may appear meaningless at first blush.
So we just have a couple minutes left. Let me see. Are there any questions from the audience, either about some of the federal initiatives we talked about, campus issues, maybe an issue we haven't discussed that you want to share? Any comments or questions? Yes. So questions about the disposal of equipment, and do you have a policy to that effect?
We don't have a separate policy that talks about disposal or secure, you know, deletion of data. But in our various policies, for instance, in that computer security policy I referred to earlier, We have best practice relating to secure deletion and some guidance related to that. So it's not so much policy as guidance, although when we're talking about regulated data like FERPA data or HIPAA data, it gets tighter. Then it becomes a matter of awareness, like the law requires you to have this level of protection, so if you're getting rid of this protected data, it must be done this way. So it's not, it's really guidance about what law requires and then information about how to do it.
We have a process which is almost policy agnostic, is that the process gets repeated and it's done each time and to things are cleaned to the extent that everything is going to be cleaned. So it's not saying that, I mean, that would be a good idea to say, well, this particular machine held this or that, but I don't think we're that sophisticated to do that. So our policy tends to be agnostic to what it may contain. It's going to be wiped, and so it's a process, deep down process under our network.
Let me take just one final question, and then we need to break. Yes, in the back of the room.
Yeah, we have obviously a bigger, our outreach effort is big into that area. And then when I go out with groups, sometimes I will actually use HIPAA, which is a great security framework. It's a great security framework to break it down more simply to say here's our technical security, here is our administrative security, and here's our physical security. That makes up our total security picture. And then we give the analogy about all of these things we're doing is 20%, 80% is the old adage. We give you we put a lock on your door. That's 20%. 80% is you remembering to lock the door, to remembering to come to work, things like that. So we have it. We use the HIPAA framework, and I don't call it a HIPAA framework. I think it's a good security framework. It's a good one that people can understand out there. And HIPAA does a real nice job in the physical security, and it makes it easy to explain to people about their role.
So let me just quickly close with a few resources. The Higher Education Information Security Council is really where matters of information security are discussed and tools and processes developed. I mentioned the Information Security Guide. There's actually guidelines on media sanitization and disposal of equipment. All that information's at the educause.edu/security website. On the area of privacy, we have not developed a specific initiative per se, but we've partnered very closely with the International Association of Privacy Professionals, IAPP, people like Moore and others. There's quite few of them in higher education, certainly many in medical centers, but certainly a lot growing in growing importance in IT and the like, and so we kind of have some ad hoc activities there as well. The EDUCAUSE Cornell Institute for Computer Policy and Law is another place where certainly campus policy issues and practice get discussed a lot, especially the translating from public policy legislation down through regulation and campus policy and compliance. They have an annual institute and also have an active discussion group as well. So lots of resources that exist in the community. The EDUCAUSE Washington office, of course, is in Washington, D.C. to work with the government to both stay informed about what's happening and influence developments as much as we can. So thank you for coming. If you have further questions, feel free to come up and talk to us afterwards or be in touch with us later. Thank you very much.
You can find more EDUCAUSE podcasts by visiting our podcast page at www.educause.edu/podcasts or search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. EDUCAUSE podcasts are now available to listen to straight from your mobile device. Just visit www.educause.edu/mobile. I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.